Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. The title of today's show is Max Knows What Winning Is About, eh? And that is from Richard Crosson on Twitter. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners, so let's be friends. Welcome to the Montreal race review. There was a grandstand finish to enjoy at Montreal and a good Canadian Grand Prix, as I've said many times in the past, like most temporary tracks, needs rain or a safety car. But luckily in Montreal, there's usually plenty of both. So we had a nice rain-filled practice and qualifying, and we had some safety cars to spice things up during the race. And on a Sunday that looked for all the world like it was going to be a Verstappen stroll in the park, we were treated to some classic F1 chase down to the finish. So coming up, we'll discuss, do Ferrari and Mercedes have anything left in the tank to chase titles? Can Hamilton and Mercedes build on that race form? And should we end safety car lotteries? We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed. With the kind permission of our better halves, we aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. I'm joined in the shed by Matt Two Rumpets.
Busy looking at all the pit stops.
Good, because you are our gateway to strategy. We're also joined by Kyle Edgy Power.
For once, VSCs enabled strategy rather than denying us of strategy.
It did. They came at exactly the right time. And from Australia, we're joined by Jonathan Simon.
It's good to be back. That's all I'm going to say. It's good to be back. What a race. Like that one.
What time was the race for you, Jono?
4 o'clock in the morning. But I said before, I'm actually not tired for this one. Every time I jump on Missed Apex, my memories are, my head's ringing. I need a coffee. I feel pretty good at the moment.
Now you finally know how hard it's been for us Brits for some of the late races. But let's get on and let's talk about where the race was won and lost. Now, normally we do tend to start these kind of shows off on a big ticket item and talk about like the most interesting and exciting thing that happened, the thing that you're going to want to tune in for. We don't mess around. We just get to it. But I think today the big thing is kind of a non-event. Leading up to the race, Matt, it was all about what would Alonso do at turn one?
Yes. And clearly Alonso was going to dive bomb Verstappen or even cut that turn entirely, take the lead, and then just refuse to hand it back and ruin everybody's day except for, well, I think reality had a different plan.
I'm as guilty as any social media person of going, oh, he's definitely going to send it into turn one. Magic Alonso.
Yeah, I think this was one of the most overhyped race starts that I've ever known personally. I don't think he was ever going to do a crazy move because I think he really quite likes Verstappen. And I think he was mainly just playing up for the cameras and the show. So I wasn't surprised when it was a bit of a damp squib. I just want to get that term in quickly.
Nice.
I remember in our group chat, somebody said, I don't know if it was you, Kyle, but somebody said, oh, this is an overhyped sort of Alonso thing. And he's done it again. This is a Fernando Alonso trick where he'll say something in the media, gets everybody hyped, and you're like, oh, when are we going to learn to stop listening to the man?
I think the thing with Fernando Alonso, like a lot of struggling governments, is that, and like I actually said about Ferrari as well, he's always just looking at the next session. What is the thing that will make me look good in the moment? And like Alonso has previous, doesn't he, Kyle, of like in a practice session, just randomly taking the fuel out and just getting up to the top of the timing sheets just to get back up there, just to show his name on the top.
Yeah, a bit of glory running. That's what I thought they were doing on Friday a little bit. I thought they might have been glory running on their race pace because everyone's like, oh my God, it looks really, really strong. And I'm just like, I think they're going and grabbing headlines a bit like Prost in pre-season testing. So I do think there's a bit of that. It's keeping themselves at the front and relevant and in the press and saying, look, I am the magic maestro. Like, I'm here all the time. And also that might have played into the strategy a little bit in this race, even though I could be completely wrong.
Okay, so Alpine ended up, they did have a pretty good weekend, despite not quite failing, not quite managing to live up to the hype. We'll definitely get back to Alpine. But without a doubt, the highlight of this race weekend, Matt, was the battle between Max Verstappen and Carlos Sainz. I think it was all the sweeter for the fact that no one was really expecting Sainz to take it to Verstappen. And as Kyle mentioned, the virtual safety cars just seemed to give us this seesaw backwards and forwards where we never really knew who was ahead throughout the Grand Prix.
No, I mean, I think if you look at it overall, I think the Ferrari had the slightly better platform at Montreal. And we can assume this because Sainz is usually a bit slower than Leclerc, because we're in Montreal. So I guess I'll give it the French pronunciation.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it is you're right. We didn't know until the very last lap, really, and until the end of lap 69, if Sainz was going to pull it off or not. And I think that's a lot of credit to Carlos and a lot of credit to Red Bull for keeping Verstappen there. And, oh, yeah, it just was so fun to watch.
Yeah, I was actually really surprised he mounted such a challenge because, you know, no disservice to Carlos Sainz, but this is against Max Verstappen, who's an absolute beast and an animal. And I just didn't think that Sainz would actually get that close, but I think it was like two or three laps after the restart. He was super, super close. And then he completely hung on. So, and also Verstappen obviously not been able to communicate with the team or anything. It might have been playing on his mind a little bit. So credit to Sainz because he absolutely hustled him and hounded him the whole way. But I think where he come unstuck was he was absolutely monstering the sausage curbs. He was, the Ferrari could ride them better, but he was really taking advantage and abusing them. But an incredible effort. He got really, really close. And it would have been great if he would have got close enough for a crazy send on the last lap. Yeah. But I think he's far too sensible for that.
It's always interesting every weekend to figure out who's quicker, Red Bull or Ferrari. And it was hard to determine that this weekend at Canada because of all the penalties, because of Perez's effort in qualifying, the rain, all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, what I was impressed by was you had your top three as usual. It was Red Bull, Ferrari in whatever order, Mercedes third quickest. Alpine being the fourth quickest car isn't always like that every week. And they had a really good car in the wet and the dry, and they really proved it throughout practice. We talked about them maybe having some glory running. I don't think it was the case. Normally, it's always at Alfa Romeo or some other team in fourth. So a real good, interesting pecking order in Canada.
Okay. But where I sort of... I think the point where we lost who was indeed in front, Matt, was that first virtual safety car round of pit stops. So Perez, I don't mind, I'm neutral, but oh my goodness, right. We've been bigging up the title push for Perez. Like, is he there? Is he still within a chance? He's still within a race win, even though you know, he didn't have the race pace in Baku. Then the gearbox conks out. So realistically, for now, until there's a big turnaround, I'm going to park my Perez title push as much as it hurts. So he causes a virtual safety car. About half the field decide to pit, and that's what sets us apart. And I do love these kind of races. You know, that's what you get with, you know, when you talk about Bahrain with that the battle in the desert between Rosberg and Hamilton. When you have drivers diverge on different strategies that are then going to come back together later on in the race, that's some of the most fascinating Grand Prix.
It is, but it was a really badly timed effort by Perez. I mean, this was like lap 9, lap 10. And it's too long to really get to the, I mean, you might eke the tires out.
So you're saying Perez messed up by inducing the virtual safety car too early.
The gearbox failed too soon.
Too early. Okay, come on, Red Bull.
They did not do the job. They pushed the button at the wrong time.
Are we saying that they've put little explosive charges on components in the gearbox that they can trigger when they want or on a delayed time fuse?
I wasn't going to start a conspiracy theory, but I think, Matt, you noted the Tsunoda safety car was caused at a reasonably convenient time. Perez is one, also brought out a safety car. So yeah, there might be just Helmut Marko in the background going, okay, deploy order 1-1, and that's Perez gone.
To be fair, it's quite I was quite surprised to see them pit that early, and that was telling me that I think they already knew they weren't going to be able to make the one stop work.
Oh, they
already fully committed to
the
two stop, and they just took the opportunity. And it was surprising that I think it was out of the top group, it was only Lewis that followed them in as well. So that safety car and that VSC, and I can't remember a time when a VSC has actually improved the strategy or the strategy dynamics of the race. And it was perfect because then we had Lewis and Verstappen on this alternate strategy now. And then the others, and obviously Science was obviously instructed to do the opposite. And it was just fascinating. But I think the second one sort of killed it slightly because I thought Science might have been trying to get to the end.
Yeah, so I think what you said was key, that they'd already in their heads gone, oh, this is probably going to be a two-stopper. Because I think a lot of the time, the teams are stretching for the one-stopper. And what the virtual safety car does is it takes any peril out because they all take the cheap stop, get that one stop out of the way. So on a street track like Singapore, Montreal, Monaco, Australia, that kind of thing, as soon as there's that virtual safety car early on, or even like Sochi, actually, they go, oh, right, this is the chance to just take that one stop, and that kills any tactics. Obviously, in Sochi, it's because of low tyre wear rather than poor overtaking. But here, it did really add to the race. Jono?
I think you have to take a virtual safety car pit stop almost, not all the time, but you have to strongly consider it. Ferrari, there's no excuses for them in a good way. You know, they decided to do the opposite. You have to do that when you're racing Verstappen at that stage. But for Hamilton to come in and not Russell, I'm not sure if that was a driver call or a team call. That's something else that was a little bit weird. At the end of the day, I thought strategy was kind of easy to follow because once the first virtual safety car came out, if you didn't take that opportunity, it nullified the effect at the second one. And then the strategy became either, okay, who has pitted and who hasn't? And it sort of became that type of race. But it did open up the door for a lot of people to try something different.
Yeah, and it was actually quite a bold decision from Red Bull. They're leading the race. They have the most to lose. And I think we've seen Mercedes previously in these sorts of situations and haven't dictated
the
strategy.
They've waited to react. Yeah.
And this was quite a kind of an authoritative and bold move from Red Bull to actually take it. So it was quite surprising because it was, you know, for all intent and purposes, it was looking like Verstappen was just going to breeze off into the distance.
But this is the difference. Red Bull have never been reactive. They've always been proactive with this kind of stuff, Matt.
They have. I think it was a sign of weakness, however, because I will point out that once Carlos Sainz got round Alonso, the gap to Verstappen did not move. And let's consider that they were on the medium tire and that the medium tire, which is normally the soft tire, and that graining tends to start happening on that tire right around lap 10 or 11 on a full fuel load. I'll say it correct now. And I think they looked at the fact that they weren't able to put any extra space between them and Sainz and realized that at least on this tire, they might have been up against it, and perhaps they were hoping Sainz would lose time in a graining phase compared to them, and that would give them a bit of an advantage later on when they needed to make their second stop.
I'll tell you this. At the end of the day, you talked about Red Bull being proactive. Ferrari's kind of reacted and did their own thing. Alpine, did they not proact or react, or what the hell was going on with them? You know, I have no clue what happened with them. We'll go to them a little bit later, but they were nothing. Yeah. They didn't even, they were just standing there the whole race.
I'm not going to do it now. I'm not going to spoil it. I've got a defense. Oh. I've got a defense for Alpine. Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about, though. And
what in the world was that?
It definitely did seem like that. But in a way, yes, Jono, you're right. Once you realise that basically both strands of that strategy both got a free virtual safety car, then it kind of it evened out. And the fact that, like Kyle is saying, that the one stop was never going to work, actually everyone was pretty even leading up to that safety car. In fact, sorry, we'll go to you, Matt, here, because if we go with your conspiracy theory that Tsunoda is like, right, okay, Tsunoda, into the wall now, we need a safety car to shore things up for Max. If it had been later, Max would have come out, Sainz would have come out with much fresher tyres than Verstappen. But with only a 6-lap difference, really, that safety car neutralized the entire race. And what we got from then on was a very, like a Montreal sprint on a track, you know, a dry Montreal, not very conducive to overtaking. And there wasn't very much after the safety car. So as much as the virtual safety car set us up for this grand finale and it was exciting, really that final safety car just neutralized it and killed the strategy.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of interesting points to come out of this. First of all, I think for Sainz, it was a big loss, because let's remember that he changed tires around lap 20. Now, we saw in the race, we saw Bottas go all the way to lap to the safety car, 49 laps on those hard tires, and he wasn't really losing pace, which means that Sainz was in the window for a one-stopper to work for him. Verstappen on fresher tires was catching him, but maybe not quite fast enough to make Red Bull happy. So, Yuki, could you hit the wall, please? I'm sure that's exactly what was said.
Okay.
And he said, oh, I'll do it in a way that no one will forget.
Make it look like an accident. Yeah.
Exactly.
I agree with Matt. I think I put it in our group chat during a race. I think science was nailed on for the one stop, because remember during the first stint, his team come out and said, we're still on plan A. The tire wear, the deg is better than we expected. So I actually think science would have done it. For some reason, Ferrari seemed to be looking after their tires better than Red Bull for this race, which is a bit of a flip-flop on what we've seen previously. And yeah, I think we were going to be treated to a Verstappen hunting down Sainz for the win in the final few laps. And the actual full-blown safety car kind of denied this of that, but still set us up for a good finish.
I think Verstappen, personally, I think he would have passed Sainz anyway, you know, regardless of the safety car. You know, I think that's what was happening. The critical part at the end of the race was, as much as a lot of people might think, oh, you know, it kind of ruined that lead battle, and we had a thrilling final few laps. Yeah. I thought that was great. But also, the critical part for Verstappen is, and there's two things. Number one, he's very, very talented at defending, and it's very, very hard to pass him. Number two, the traction that Red Bull had coming out of the hairpin, coming out of the final chicane, in all the critical zones where he could be passed, it was like they'd set up the ERS or the deployment or something in that car, or he just had a better setup coming out of the corners where it was just so hard to pass him. I don't think he got passed all race, right? No, he didn't. Well, pretty much just, yeah.
Yeah, the thing is, though, all season, Honda Red Bull has been great in a straight line. So that's not a massive surprise. But I do think Matt has a point that without the safety car, it would have been Verstappen trying to hunt down Sainz. And to be honest, all the way through the later stints, it did look like Sainz had, and I'm staring, in fact, we were staring at the lap time so intently, I actually had to pull my boy away from the live timings. It was a race that was so good to watch on the live timings that he was just absolutely engrossed. But I think you're right, Matt. I think Ferrari had a chance with Sainz to hold and like manage maybe a 5-second gap without that safety car.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can think about Max pitted lap 43, as I recall. But we could look at Sainz going from 9 seconds to 6 seconds. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh, Sainz took half a second out. Sainz took a half second out. I mean, the commentators were noticing it, which means it was a big deal. But I will put to you another interesting thing is if you were to compare the Red Bull pit stop timings to the Carlos Sainz pit stop timings, you'd have more than Verstappen's margin of victory right there alone.
So are you saying Ferrari'd?
I'm just saying that maybe Ferrari need to be looking to their pit stops relative to Red Bull as an area of performance where they can improve.
Jono.
I agree. I think they need to improve there. But, you know, in this race, obviously, trumpets that the safety car is the reason why Sainz was stuck behind Verstappen or he couldn't pass him. Like, I don't think a pit stop was going to make the difference there, because at the end of the day, the safety car brought the gap down.
Yeah, that's true.
But I do agree with you, when it comes down to a battle later on in the season where it could come down to the final race like we had last year, Ferrari's got to look at this kind of stuff, the attention to detail.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that if his first stop had been faster, he would have might have had the margin, and especially if the second stop during the safety car had been faster, he might have been even with or slightly ahead of Verstappen when he came out of the pits. That was my point.
Yeah, and look, we have said time and time again that Ferrari are dropping a lot of the little decisions, a lot of the little tactical decisions, not so little at Monaco. But we know that's an issue. We've highlighted that. And for everyone who's wanting Ferrari to take the challenge to Red Bull this season, you know, we're all screaming at the TVs at Ferrari, and we're saying, you know, perhaps they are hasty in these kind of situations. So we know that's true. However, given that Sainz is very much the number two driver at Ferrari, sorry, Matt, but he's very much the number two driver. Had that been Charles Leclerc up front, Kyle, different?
Yeah, I was just about to make a very similar point. Like, imagine if that was Leclerc in that situation there, I think we would have had a much fiercer fight. I mean, we have seen it. I'm not just dunking on Sainz. He was my hot tip for the season. And I do very much like him. But we have seen in every single race that Leclerc has had a comfortable advantage on race pace over him. So actually, Leclerc's going to be kicking him, not kicking himself. He's going to be very, very down and annoyed, because I think if he was in Sainz's shoes or car, I think he probably would have won.
I'm not convinced that even if you grant Leclerc that 0.2 of a second, that the Delta would have been enough for that Ferrari to get around a Red Bull in front.
Because the Red Bull's fast in all the right places. Yeah,
exactly. But what I do want to point out is that for all everyone's been talking about Ferrari reliability, it was a Red Bull that went bang today.
Yeah.
And I don't think either of these two top teams is anywhere near in a window like Mercedes was in the previous set of regulations as far as reliability is concerned.
Well, I don't know who these people are. I mean, do people remember Red Bull's reliability troubles? The first couple of races, Verstappen lost so many points. So it's pretty even at the moment. You know, I think Ferrari can step it up. Red Bull can step it up. But let me tell you this, we're not even 10 races into the season, I don't think. This is round 9, wasn't it?
Yep.
I'm pretty sure.
Yep. Yep.
And so there's it's one of the longest seasons in F1 history, or the longest. And so there's going to be a lot of races to come by. Remember, we used to have seasons that were 16 races long. So this is 13 races to go, and you could easily have a couple of DNFs. Easily stretch the advantage.
So I think the numbers are, if we talk about race-ending failures, DNFs, I think it's Red Bull 4 and Ferrari 3. It's just the way they were weighted. Obviously, Red Bulls all came at the beginning of the season, 2 for Verstappen, 1 for Perez, and now 2 for Perez. And then the Ferrari ones came later. We shouldn't forget that early on in the season, we were afraid it was going to be a boring Ferrari-dominated season. And it's turned around very quickly. I think Alonso's lead is... not Alonso. Where did that come from?
You've been reading too much into it.
10 years ago. Verstappen's
sucked into the hype.
Verstappen's lead is something like 80 points, isn't it? You know, he's a good 3 race wins away, is he, from the nearest non-Red Bull driver? Or maybe 2 race wins away.
Two races.
I might have been confusing it with the Constructors' Championship there. I think that could still swing back when you're looking at these reliability figures, Jono.
Yeah, and this could easily happen. Look, we've seen this. I think it was Imola or before Leclerc had that little spin. I went on this podcast and I said, Leclerc should take 2 races off and he'd still pretty much have the championship lead. Look what happened. He did take 2 races off. He became the driver who went on holiday for a bit in his own mind and caused all this trouble. He's had engine failures. Now he's 2 races behind. Literally a 100-point turnaround almost.
I think the thing with the Ferrari failures and why they seem more prominent is that it's happened to them when they've been in the race lead or in a leading position, whereas the Red Bull ones is when they're already on the back foot, then had the failures. Whereas Ferrari, I mean, we've seen it in recent history, don't want to dunk on them too much, but they have got quite a good track record of choking and getting things wrong and stuff like that, and reliability issues and spins for their drivers. So I'd like to see them come back. I don't really have much faith in them being able to do it.
Kyle, I want to talk about the hunt that we enjoyed so much. And it was thrilling, but I have to say, perhaps after the fourth chase down the back straight, I thought, this isn't going to happen. And you, more than any of us, have been in these racing situations, especially, I know you do a lot of like rental karting, and you'll get the one car that turns really well, and you'll get the other car that is just like a rocket ship down the straight because it's got a, I know the choke is like just set differently. The cars were just set up in such a way that a slight advantage on the straight, it was always going to be hard, near impossible for Sainz. I think he made a really good fist of it. But yeah, just describe like the challenge of that driver chasing with that kind of straight line deficit.
Well, it was mainly all about how he was deploying the ERS energy. They were saving it all up. So Verstappen was obviously keeping a very good eye on what Sainz was doing behind. And obviously Verstappen wasn't really deploying that much, I would say, in the first couple of sectors.
Hang on, who deploys it, Kyle? The driver?
Well, they set strategies and how they deploy it. And then they also have an overtake button. So they're obviously being allowed to hit the overtake button and get an extra sort of deployment. And obviously you can only do that so many times.
And obviously I understand all this, but for listeners who might be new to this, the overtake button, is that just tapping into some extra harvested, recovered battery energy?
Yeah, it's basically like a brief, short burst of full bananas mode. It's almost like quali mode that you'll get, and you just hit it and you'll get, you know, and you drain your battery really, really fast. Obviously, that is not sustainable over a race, and they won't be doing it much. And remember Lando Norris, I think it was at Austria a couple of years ago, and his engineer in the last couple of laps saying, hit the overtake button, press and hold it for 5 seconds on the exit of turn four when they're trying to chase down Hamilton with a penalty to get his first podium. And he was instructing Lando to hold it for set amounts of seconds. So this is probably what Sainz and Verstappen both had. They probably knew they had so many, like a certain amount of seconds they could use it per lap. So they weren't using it much through the middle sector. And then obviously Max would save it all up to basically dump most of his battery down the straight to counteract the DRS.
But aren't they both just doing that? So they come out of the hairpin and they both just dump overtake button.
This is the game. So where I thought Sainz may have had the best possible chance was to actually do that for the first couple of laps. Verstappen had him sussed pretty quickly, but then don't do that. You see him, I think it was about lap three.
Yeah, he suddenly kind of dropped back DRS, to recharge. Yeah.
And then actually, I think his best sort of chance would have been a George Russell or Leclerc-esque lunge into the hairpin before. So if he would have dumped and used the deployment a bit more to get close to Verstappen before the hairpin and did that, but then he would have been very vulnerable on the straight afterwards.
And we were watching the timings again. Obviously, coming out the hairpin, he seemed to be about 0.7, 0.8 behind. That would close to about 0.4, 0.5, not close enough to overtake. And then, you know, he'd get into turn one, turn two, under half a second. But Verstappen was on it in sector one. So Verstappen was still setting purples in sector one and pulling away that gap. By the time they got to the hairpin, Matt, it was always back down to 0.8, 0.9. And it wasn't enough to then compensate down the straight.
Yeah, and this is where I think you could see Leclerc with his strategy. He had the tire advantage as well, which I think let him make that lunge to the inside of turn 10, which is the hairpin. But I think you could also take what Kyle said, is that fundamentally the teams work out how to deploy energy for the car and see that Ferrari was very much using the first sector to recover a lot of energy, I think, relative to Red Bull.
Yeah, these are
sorry, Jono, quickly, then Carl.
I was going to say the energy per lap. I'm not sure if how the rules evolved over the years, but there's a certain amount you can use per lap, I know, with the ERS2. So if you use something all along the back straight, you've got to give it up somewhere else. And as we spoke about before, if an overtaking driver, if it's signs on, for example, Verstappen at the end of the race, they both use it at the hairpin, it can nullify the effect. Mm. That's one thing. If Verstappen decides to use it across the straight, he's got to give it up maybe in the second sector. And so if you can't overtake in that sector, well, that's the way it works. That's what you might as well go for.
Okay, but here's the thing. We expected Verstappen to dominate today. Clearly in that final sector, Kyle, that was not him managing a gap. That was both drivers at full bananas. Is that the
full bananas. That's a technical term.
Both drivers were full bananas. And that's what is glorious about it. You know, when you see a gap of like 5 seconds, you go, ah, the lead driver, he was never really pushing. This was both drivers really at the limit.
Yeah, they were absolutely pushing as hard as they could. And also it's good for the tyres. They weren't having to back off and cooking the tyres. They were both just absolutely
good.
Caning it and absolutely going for it. So I think the best way Sainz would have had a chance to overtake it would have been on an offset on his battery sort of strategy and how you're doing that. But they're trying to figure this out as they're driving around. And also the teams don't really want to tell them, because the other team would just instantly hear and just tell them and just say, well, he's going to use his battery in sector two. So just do the same to match him.
Okay, you're wrong. Sainz's best chance at winning this was a Verstappen mistake. And in this situation, we just do not see, annoyingly, Jono, we don't. In this situation, we do not see Verstappen stuff it.
It's not 2019 Canada, the last time we raced. Yeah, was it Sebastian Vettel going off the tracks? We didn't see Verstappen switching pit boards. It wasn't one of those situations. Yeah,
look, Vettel switching pit boards, yeah.
That was actually, funnily enough, that was the last time we raced here. It's actually hard to believe, you know, that was the last time we're at Montreal. But look, at the end of the day, I this might be a controversial take. I have got so much more to say other than this lead battle. I felt like the lead battle was simple. Someone couldn't take someone else. Right. It was interesting. I enjoyed it. But the rest of the midfield and the rest of that was so entertaining behind.
Jono, I hear you. Let's move on. Let's just nibble behind a little bit, because there's been a huge amount of talk about the Mercedes recovery. Lewis Hamilton has had his head and his chin firmly buried into his sternum for most of the season after the season opener, and we're starting to see little glimmers of hope. So the journey has been, they're porpoising too much, they've got no pace, they're absolutely nowhere. In Barcelona, they threw us a cruel nugget of hope. And by us, I mean people who would wish Mercedes and Hamilton well. I've given away my bias. Again, a feature, not a bug. Kyle has been a Ferrari fan and a Schumacher fan. Yet, despite that, we are somehow able to remain friends. I don't know how, but we've managed it. Matt has incorrectly been an Ocon fan, even when he was up against the magnificent Perez and my kebab meat and chips Fernando Alonso. And Jono presumably supports Daniel Ricciardo. Don't argue, Jono. You're Australian. That's how it works. You supported Mark Webber. Now you support Daniel Ricciardo. So for those well wishers, the people who were wishing well for Mercedes, Barcelona was a nugget of hope. Monaco obviously didn't really show, you know, that street circuit kind of vibe didn't quite click, and then Baku did nothing to really dispel the myth, the thought that they hadn't got a hold of the porpoising. The bumps at Azerbaijan really did seem to unsettle this Barcelona solution. Toto Wolff was asked, what's going on? He said, well, we need a marble racetrack. It's not this. Baku is not the smooth track we need. Also, Montreal is not the smooth track we need. But given that this was a track that was not meant to be the start of the resurgence of Mercedes, and we've been looking forward, again, we, the royal we of Mercedes apologists, given that Silverstone was meant to be the resurgence, things, I think, looked reasonably positive here in Montreal. And I tweeted that things looked good, and a lot of people yelled at me and said, no, it was still rubbish. So, Jono, Is this a good race? Is this race a good sign for Mercedes?
Who the hell knows? You know why? Because when we went to Monaco, we all thought slow speeds at Monaco. We all thought, okay, this porpoising issue is happening at high speeds on straights. Mercedes are going to win Monaco. They got such a great car. They were even worse. They were suffering so badly.
Street track.
Baku, another street track.
Same
thing as you say.
Yeah.
Bang. Canada, street track. This is a street circuit. And can I tell you something? This circuit is notorious for bumps.
Yeah.
Those braking zones are terrible at Montreal. And for some reason, the car's performing well. They don't understand the problem, obviously. We don't understand it. Nobody understands it. What is going on with that car at Mercedes?
Well, it's actually a pretty easy answer. It's two parts. One, we had a green track to race on, which, if you'll recall, Miami Mercedes on the green track.
Please explain a green track.
Oh, I'm sorry. A green track means one that's not had a lot of race cars driving on it. Therefore, there's not a lot of rubber on the racing line for the tires to interact
with. Okay, so we think that's Mercedes are performing better on a green track.
That's one. And then the other is even simpler. If you were just to look at the speed trap numbers during the race, you'd see that the fastest lap that I think Lewis Hamilton did, he hit a maximum of about 280 kilometers an hour in the speed trap, which doesn't mean it's his fastest speed, but just as a fixed point of reference, that's what it was. And I'd say that the speeds are below the speeds that really caused them the big problems. Whereas in Azerbaijan, you had the exact opposite problem. Yeah. Not only did you have bumps, you had massive high speed. So I think it's reasonable at this point to assume that any track that falls into those categories is going to be probably a good one for them.
I think Spain, that was certainly not a green track. Like that to me was Formula 2, Formula 3 racing there. A lot of rubber laid
out. Super smooth though.
It's smoother. Mercedes were very quick there. You know, they had race pace to, some people allege they could have won the race. I don't think so. I think they were the second best car behind Red Bull. But the point is that I just don't think anyone knows what this problem is and how to fix it. And if they did, it would be fixed by now. They've had enough time since preseason testing. It's weird. Some people allege that it was initially porpoising. Now it's become this bouncing issue. It's a separate issue. I've got no clue. I just need a break from figuring this out. Just focus on next year's car. I don't know. Change the rules.
Do you know what? I found myself, I was on a little jog and I found myself like thinking, well, you know, trying to solve the problem for Mercedes and going, well, they need to send a spy into Red Bull and find out where those internal side pod supports are. Kyle.
Yeah. Another thing to add to the Mercedes issues is the car and the chassis, they said, is incredibly stiff and rigid, and it's got a bad ride issue. Now, think back to 2013 McLaren, when they changed to a pull rod front suspension, and it was just the drivers were complaining massively, massively of the ride, and they got the suspension kinematics slightly wrong, and they had a horrible ride on the car. Mm. And that's what Ferrari struggled with a little bit in 2012.
Kyle, isn't also, 2013 when McLaren put certain components upside down and it made no difference?
Pretty much, I think. Yeah, yeah. It was when Perez's first year with McLaren.
Wasn't that the year where they had a full sail at the back?
The big blockers
on the rear suspension, and that got dumped very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Mercedes has a few issues, and Toto Wolff has sort of alluded to it, that they're just trying to figure it out. So they're either slamming it on the ground, whether they raise it up or not, they're still getting porpoising, but the porpoising is only one sort of facet to the problem. They've got really hard suspension. They've got much more simplified suspension systems on all cars this year, and their chassis is very, very rigid, very stiff. The car's got a poor ride. So I think they've got three or four individual problems, and finding out, I've had this with electron beam guns and machines before. When you have so many problems in one, as you will know as well, they mask each other, and it's really hard to pinpoint where the actual problem is. So they're a little bit lost, but they seem to be happier. After the race, Toto said in an interview that we at least know we have a direction to head in now. We think we have a direction, because look at Friday. Hamilton was very despondent and said it was a complete disaster. And so they've changed the setup, and all of a sudden in the race, it was like, it works. It's just got an incredibly small window. They just need to know where that window is. And I think they're slowly starting to figure it out.
That was quite good, Matt. Toto gave an interview where he said, we need to go into business selling tarmac and smoothing out tracks and go around the world, making sure that every track is like a marble table.
Yes. Well, I know someone we can introduce him to. We've interviewed him already.
That's true. Yeah.
I just wanted to make the point that Barcelona is a lower speed track for overall top speed. And I think those are the two parameters Mercedes are looking at. The higher the speed, the more problems they have. And then the bumpier the pavement, the more problems they have.
Okay. I meant to say this in the Red Bull versus Ferrari battle. Quick diversion back to that. Do we think that now the kind of point and squirt street circuits are more or less done with, apart from Singapore, maybe the Ferrari philosophy of higher downforce and then less straight line speed at the moment, maybe that will bode well better at tracks like Silverstone at Paul Ricard, where you can use that extra downforce to either get away or get closer down the straight. Like, 'cause today it was all about getting it stopped at the hairpin And then both Leclerc and Sainz were really struggling, basically getting the power to the back wheels. So their extra aerodynamic downforce didn't really do them any favours, because it was all about mechanical grip, getting the weight to the back wheels and then getting going. And by the time they did that, Red Bull Honda had that straight line advantage. Could that go away? I can't help banging the drum and just reminding everyone, Matt, that we have had 6 out of 9 races on temporary circuits which don't have those high to medium downforce corners necessarily, and that things could look very, very different once we get into the European season.
And you're absolutely right. Each of these tracks tends to be, especially the street tracks, tends to be its own individual thing. And it's always going to come down to balancing the car correctly between the front and rear axle to protect the tires. I think Ferrari had won that battle today, but Red Bull were fortunate with the timing of the random incidents that we love Montreal for. And I think we can see it tip back and forth, and it's going to be, I think it might be hard to pick out who does best at what circuit, because I think both cars are kind of inside the window where either can take it if they absolutely nail down the setup relative to the rival.
I enjoy this. It might be, and I mean, I could be wrong with this, but the first time in the turbo hybrid era where you kind of don't know who's going to win on a race weekend. Every time you come in, I mean, you probably know it's Red Bull or Ferrari, so maybe that's a point proven. Yeah. But it reminds me of 2007. Yes, I apologize for going back 15 years, but that year, for people who didn't watch Formula One back then, you didn't know if it was going to be Ferrari or McLaren at the time who were going to win, and every race it was different. You're like, okay, look, oh, Ferrari's got the fastest car. Oh, no, wait, next race it's actually McLaren, and you didn't know, and I feel like it's the same here season at the moment.
If Mercedes go to Silverstone, it all clicks. It's a nice smooth track with lots of high to medium speed corners, and Mercedes go and pick up a 1-2. That kind of blows the season wide open, and you go, ah, we really do not know track to track which team is going to win. But I would like to zoom in for a second and go to the Mercedes inter-team battle, which may or may not exist. So certainly there's a lot of people who dislike Lewis Hamilton, who would like to see the end of the Hamilton era, who have been picking up on saying, well, Russell has been beating Hamilton. I think he's beat him the last 4 or 5 races in a row. And then the Hamilton fans have been going, not so fast, not so fast. The safety cars have been, he's been cursed. He's had a safety car curse. He's angered the safety car gods. But I don't personally think that there is a real battle in Mercedes. I think they are internally solving problems at the moment. I think it's far too early to draw comparisons between Hamilton and Russell's performance. But, Jono, that battle has certainly been playing out in the media and in social media.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
you have to look at the bigger picture. Formula One is not a football or basketball where you always know somebody's going to kick better. Generally, they're going to win. I know it's not the best analogy, but in F1, there's a lot of luck that comes into hand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Australia, Hamilton was the quicker driver.
Yeah.
You know, what was the other race? It was the second one later on where I thought Hamilton was better. Spain, that's the one I'm thinking of, where he was so much quicker than Russell.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, here's Lewis Hamilton's issue. It's qualifying. Every time he qualifies poorly, it puts himself in a bad position and he falls to bad luck during the race. If he would qualified better than Russell and was in a better position, Russell would be the person who suffers from that bad luck instead. And so finally, Lewis Hamilton has qualified ahead. He's got a great position. It rained. He got a bit of luck on his hands with Russell deciding to go to slicks. And look at Lewis's race. He's finally got a podium. So I think if Lewis can sort out qualifying, which is more important to me than his race pace, I think he's going to have and win that intra-team battle.
Yeah, that's quite right. I don't know whether I want to say he will completely win it because I think Russell has been very, very good and very strong this year. But if we look it all out on paper, and as we've pointed out already, Hamilton's had some awful luck with the safety car, and we haven't had many races where they've had a direct comparison in clear air on race pace where they've not been caught up or been in a messy sort of situation. And I was surprised this race because, again, throughout the weekend, Russell was looking like the stronger or the more comfortable driver again. But then come race day, Lewis seemed to have comfortably the better race pace today. Like when, as Maria Klados in the chat, rightfully points out, when the tyre strategies were neutralized, Lewis was consistently faster. And this is what happened in the last stint. I think he put 4 seconds on Russell in that final stint after the safety car. And I expected Russell to be giving him a hard time. And we haven't really seen them in clear air together on a representative strategy on a comparable strategy. So actually, I think there's nothing to choose between the two drivers at the moment.
So I have loads I want to say about the teammate battle in Mercedes in the race today, but I want to make the point right now. I believe Hamilton has already ceded that battle to Russell because he said, give me all the experiments.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, give me all the experiments. I'm the lead driver. Give me the funky stuff and we'll see if it works. And I think that has consistently put his weekend behind Russell's, and his pace today demonstrates that if Mercedes had turned up with a car that was like a Red Bull or Ferrari in terms of being ready for battle, I think Hamilton's going to take it, but I don't think Hamilton cares right now. I think he wants a car that can win.
He's not
race.
Looking at Russell. He's looking at fixing the car, Jono.
I agree. Look, that's a good point as well, is that he's trying to find solutions rather than care about beating his teammate. He doesn't really care too much about that. But I will say this, and I always say this, look at the bigger picture. And if these two had raced and there was only two cars per race, if it was like a 2005 USA situation every race a season, it's 50-50. You know, Russell's had Hamilton half the time and Hamilton's had him. Now, the points difference, it shows a different picture because of, you have to understand, Formula One is not just about pure pace. There's mechanical failures, luck, safety cars. That's what can make someone look worse. The pure example, Spanners, is last year. Everyone thought Sainz was so much better than Leclerc. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. But Leclerc,
hang on,
wiped the floor with him. Even though he scored less points.
I was a lone voice of sanity. And two of the main protagonists are here in your podcast windows here, Kyle and Matt.
Well, yeah. I was with you, remember? It's
It was just us two. It was us two against those idiots. But look, I think Mercedes, the jury is out on their solution. We saw very much in 2021, don't count them out. They turned up at Brazil with just a package that annihilated the field. And that performance at the end of the 2021 season from Brazil to Abu Dhabi was extraordinary. Before that, Red Bull and Verstappen had it. They had the run, and then, you know, and then that they turned up with something. This is a team that can turn up and click and be formidable. That gap is massive right now, but like Jono said, it is a very long season, and not for this show. But Jono, you were talking about qualifying. I've come under flak for this because I think Lewis Hamilton is statistically the greatest qualifier of like all time, but I'm not a fan of his approach to qualifying. You know, I think he does kind of go a little bit all or nothing in qualifying. And a lot of the time, I just think like he would have done better if he'd have gone 99% instead of 100%.
You're saying he makes too many mistakes.
I think he sometimes over pushes in qualifying. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember back in the early McLaren days in 2010 to 2012. I always remember in Q3 when he was on that final lap, I'm like, I bet you he's going to lock up here on his final run. He had issues like that. But then there were times where you're like, when he's on it, he set some of the greatest laps you've ever seen in history, you know? You might have a point there, but end of the day, I don't want to overthink it. You know, no. They're the third quickest car. Let's just wait until they got a good car again before we start criticizing either Russell or Hamilton. By the way, you can't criticize Russell. Actually, he's doing really well.
But we are going to move on to the fourth quickest car. Alpine, Matt, it's in the battle between your favorite driver at the moment, Esteban Ocon, and my guilty pleasure, Fernando Alonso. It's a bad day for you because Fernando Alonso was 100 million billion times faster than Ocon. He said so himself, and he would never, ever tell a lie.
Yes, well, yes. And there we were at the end of the race with Ocon slowing down so Alonso could use DRS to stay ahead of Bottas.
That's fun. And then Alonso was spitting in his face. That gift horse's mouth was getting punched on the nose.
It's all right. So if you're Fernando Alonso, it's bad enough that the luck of the virtual safety car has seen your teammate ahead of you. And it's even worse when you have to, despite knowing how much faster you were, you have to take advantage of his kindness to just stay ahead of Bottas, but then to be served with a penalty, a 5-second penalty for swerving to keep Bottas out of the way. So Alonso, who was quicker, qualified second, actually finished ninth, and Ocon has quite extended his lead in the championship points over Alonso.
Yeah. That is breaking news, everybody. That did come during the podcast, that 5-second penalty. Now he's into ninth. Alpha's got more points. I'll tell you this. I agree with everything Trump had said just then, except the luck factor. I'm sorry, but not pitting under the second virtual safety car, that's not luck. That's stupidity. Oh, I don't know any idea what they were doing right there.
This is what I was referring to earlier, Jono. Oh. He passed the pits. He did not have the opportunity to pit under that safety car.
So that was it. So then he came the second time around. He didn't have the opportunity. Then I take that back. I'm sorry, Alpine. I was wrong.
Because he was too good. He was so far ahead that he outpaced the virtual safety car pit window.
Twice.
Kyle.
So both times, both VSCs happened. They missed both the VSCs and they pitted essentially under green lap, I think, like under green flag conditions. Mm-hmm. But I thought they were kind of, Martin Brundle said the sort of similar phrase in previous races, they were kind of goal hanging, I think, maybe. But was it glory running? Were they just trying to keep themselves at the front? Yeah. But it seemed like a bit of a nonsensical strategy. Otmar did say after the race that the two stop just wouldn't work for them. But why? Because they were hemorrhaging time at the front.
Yeah, it was a second a lap at one point, Matt. And you just go, well.
Well, I'm going to defend them on the first stop. They did the opposite to Hamilton there. Mm. Hamilton went in on the first VSC. They stayed out. That's rational. But if they had the opportunity to stop for the second one, like I know the second time round, he didn't get to the pits in time. So I defend them on that. But if they had the opportunity the first time round, then yeah, that's a kind of big seize on their part.
Yeah, look, I'll reserve my criticism until I look at the evidence and see when that car failed. Who was the second one? Was it Schumacher, right? The second one? Or was Perez the first
Schumacher
one?
Schumacher was the second one.
Yeah, Schumacher, yeah. Then Tsunoda.
So I'm going to see when that car pulled over, and you have to anticipate that a VSC is about to be called out. So if they're on the final straight and they've seen the news, I'm sorry, but that's not an excuse. You got to come in. But we'll reserve the criticism, Alpine, because we're not wrong, but we're first.
In the olden days, that would not have been a VSC. That would have been double waved yellows. And I think there's a bit of it's been the last 3 years where they have been much more trigger happy with the VSCs, Kyle.
Yeah, think the race directors get paid a commission on how many BSCs they throw. Probably. Okay. Yeah, they're probably commission-based. But so just as Jolly said, you can predict when if it's going to be a VSC, and that was an identical, it was at the same corner, an identical situation to Perez. So, you know, you can safely assume that that is going to be, well, presume even, that that is going to be a VSC. And Russell and Mercedes called it right. They were in the pit lane before the VSC was called. They knew it was going to be a VSC and pulled the trigger on it. So, I couldn't make head nor tail of the Alpine strategy. And also, it was a bit weird because Alonso was offset on the strategy, but he did say afterwards that from about lap 20, he had this clipping problem and an engine problem. So I was surprised when they pitted him again because he was offset on strategy. And I think they intentionally put him behind Ocon, knowing that he'd plummet down the pack if he didn't have his teammate riding shotgun for him ahead to give him DRS.
But it was the best clipping, though, Jono. 100 times better clipping than Ocon could have ever dreamed of.
Magical clipping.
He does play the political game very well. One thing, actually, quick 10-second off topic, is I miss the angry Alonso radio messages. You know, I think the last one we ever had was the Karma one in 2017 Monza, but 2005, 2006 Alonso, man, he was a crazy back then. Passion. Some of the stuff he used to say, like it was crazy. But breaking news, so about the penalty, we know he's got a 5-second penalty now. I'm glad that they penalized that. Because in my opinion, if it's the final lap of the championship as of 2021 and you swerve five times to break the toe, you can affect a race result and affect an overtake. And exactly what he did should be penalized, and that will set the scene for the rest of the season. Don't be weaving 400 times on a straight if you're 400 times better than your teammate.
Don't weave. Don't deliberately go off in qualifying. He's making a right name for himself at the moment, Kyle. He is bothering the scorers,
but everyone loves it and it's magical.
So
let's embrace it and promote it, I guess. That's how it works, isn't it?
He has
very much been playing the villain. And to be honest, this kind of harps back to McLaren sort of Honda thing. He was very vocal in the press saying that was the best qualifying lap I've ever done. We don't want to look like amateurs. Very, very, you know, I'm doing a great job here, and I'm not at the front. I think he's very angry that he's not at the front. And to be honest, he has the skill. He's an amazing driver. So he wants to be, but he's very vocal in trying to remind everybody and playing these little tricks like parking it in qualifying, like cutting corners and doing the, according to Twitter, 1,000 IQ moves on turn ones and just cut it. And he's almost trying to taunt the officials. He called them incompetent in Miami. He's trying to sort of taunt them. So I'm surprised they've pulled him up on it this time.
Oh, dear. It's a guilty pleasure. But, you know, I'm still go Nando. But we do have to play a little game, by the way. We forgot in the Mercedes bit, but little game.
Whose fault is it?
We've been a little bit unlucky this season for the Whose Fault Is It segment, because it's actually been reasonably clean. I think in 2021, there was about 18 Whose Fault Is It Is's incidents with every race. But there's not been actually that many this season. But going forward, I want this game to continue. So I want you to know the rules. So basically, in my marriage, we have the opposite of Mercedes' no blame strategy. Whenever anything goes wrong in our household, we have to immediately establish whose fault is it. If there was a fire, we wouldn't just run away. We would stop. We would argue about who caused the fire. And once we'd established it was my fault, we would then gather the pets and our favourite child. So in the spirit of that, we at Missed Apex Podcast do not acknowledge racing incidents. It is always mostly someone's fault. And in this race, we only really had one incident, but I do want to play it. So it was Kevin Magnussen who eventually got a meatball flag for his front wing being at a 45 degree angle. And Ocon going, oh my goodness, Magnussen's front wing, it spikes and fire is coming off of it. I'm scared for my life. The front wing is going to come through and it's going to bury my ancestors again and cover my descendants in curses. It was just a little bit of a flappy carbon wing. But whose fault was it? Kyle, second time we have seen Magnussen and Hamilton come together.
Yes, because I'm not allowed to say it's a racing incident, I'm going to have to say it's on Magnussen. I think this one, because again, let's look at the context of it. You're in a Haas. He knows he's not going to have the race pace. He made a very good start and is very, very aggressive, trying to overtake around the outside on an extremely tight corner on the start of the race on a street circuit and rubbing wheel to wheel. It's like, why are you even putting yourself into that situation in the first place?
You've probably watched every Canadian Grand Prix since the late 80s. Have you ever seen anyone get an overtaking on the outside of, you know, on the outside of turn three? If you are not fully ahead, it's a very, very difficult place to claim that corner. But he wasn't ahead, he was behind, and he was still squeezing Hamilton the same way he did in Barcelona. I think, like, if you squeeze someone to the point where they cannot possibly leave the apex, I think you have to say that is not a good tactic going forward for Magnussen.
No, to be fair on Magnussen, Hamilton didn't leave him a lot of room on the outside. He left that very, very tight, particularly coming out of turn two. It was extremely tight. And then I think when Hamilton realized he was there, he gave him a bit more room. But again, Magnussen leaning on him, what realistically was he going to achieve? If he got ahead in a miracle move, he would have been repassed pretty quickly again and probably would have cost himself time. But he got a mega run. He's a very aggressive driver. He'd had their best team qualifying result, so he's absolutely going for it, and he has every right to go for it. It just probably wasn't the most logical thing to go for. So very unfortunate, but I'd say slightly more Magnussen.
Yeah, it's not quite 2021. This is one of the harshest whose fault is it segments that we've had. Because it was good racing. I thought it was tough, elbows out, guys are racing hard, and just enough room was left. It wasn't like Spain. You know, Spain was obviously much worse for both these two. But again, yeah, I think Magnussen did everything right except was 1 millimeter in the wrong. And so it's kind of very harsh blaming him for that. I think a better whose fault is it segment is saying, is it Tsunoda's fault or is it the wall's fault? Oh, no, wait, it was Yuki Tsunoda. What a terrible accident.
I'd just like to sort of revisit. It is very, very harsh. I'm uncomfortable saying putting that completely on Magnussen. Yeah. And really, I do think it's a bit of a racing incident because the contact, you could barely see it. It was minimal. Okay. It was a love rock. It was a whisper, and his wing to get damaged like that, I don't think is the punishment. Okay. Crime.
Right, you coach your nephew at karting. Okay.
Yep.
Look at Barcelona. Look at this now. He's come off worse in both those situations, trying to chase a faster car, both times around the outside, both times squeezing very tight the inside car. Would you advise now your nephew to keep doing that, or to go, dude, no, that's not the one?
No, I would tell him to look at the bigger picture. What are you realistically going to achieve by getting through there? You're probably going to get passed again. You're going to cost yourself more time overall in race pace. You know the Mercedes is going to be quicker in race pace than you, most likely.
Tuck in.
Yes, you had a great one. Yeah, exactly. Tuck in and follow them, rather than try to make, you know, spherical objects to the wall move around the outside. Just maybe calm down a little bit on the first lap.
Look, let's be honest. If this was NASCAR, you wouldn't even have to buy the other car a drink for the contact that occurred.
Okay.
As far as Magnussen goes, I don't know if I would argue that, because you have three laps essentially without DRS, and the Haas was there or thereabouts with the Mercedes, especially early in the race. That's maybe in a second or two he can gain before the Mercedes gets the DRS and goes by him, and then maybe he gets a little DRS advantage. That said, the way it worked out, it was unfortunate that he was called in to fix that right before he had the opportunity to do it for way less cost anyway.
Okay, super, super quick interruption. I don't want to bother anyone, but we are a Patreon-supported podcast. Patreon.com/MissedApex. The link is in the show notes below. You can have an ad-free podcast feed. You get a link and you put that into your podcast player in the search box, and then you get an ad-free feed. And at the second tier, you get bonus content, which is worse, but you get to hear us whinging about a range of stuff. But most importantly, you are helping an independent podcast compete with the podcasts that have big backers and websites behind them and stuff like that. So I would recommend to anyone who is a podcast fan, take the same amount of money that you would use to that you have for your podcast subscriptions, sorry, for your music subscriptions, for your audiobook subscriptions, and spread that amongst podcasters as well. Not just us, but if you want to support independent podcast creators, then they will thrive and survive. Otherwise, the podcast realm will only be populated by the corporations. So if you want to stick one to the man, that's Matt, I haven't messed up there. That's not inappropriate. No, if you want to, the man, as in the corporate man, if you want to support the little guys, support podcasts. Patreon.com/MissedApex or any podcast in the podcast realm. But Matt, I want to turn to you. Alpha, Romeo, and Haas both looked good today.
They did. I mean, so let's be very clear. We saw, and full credit to you, we saw Joe at Monaco make an amazing save.
Yeah.
Coming down the hill. And you're like, maybe there's
just
something
to this
Joe guy.
Just a little bit of a thing, just a little bit. Yeah. Just
a tiny. And he then showed up in Baku and before the unfortunateness, absolutely showed his teammate a pair of heels. And he showed up in Canada and has done the same thing again. Now, granted, Alpha has been showcasing their renowned lack of reliability a bit. And that didn't help Valtteri out much. But Joe seems to have suddenly gotten to grips with the car and racing much more quickly than I'd say perhaps Tsunoda did. And he was well set to be finishing seventh in today's race before the safety car validated the bet that Alpha made on running Bottas long on the hard tires.
Yeah, Joe had an incredibly good weekend. It was so nice to hear him whooping on the radio when he got into Q3. Really good. And to be honest, to try to make it up the grid and fight and battle it in that Alfa Romeo, which looked to have a big straight line speed disadvantage, they just couldn't make it work. I wrote it in my notes before they mentioned it on the commentary. I was like, they can't pass. They have no straight. They're really struggling on top end straight line speed. So to keep your head, to not make mistakes. And, you know, yes, Bottas had a bit of a scruffy weekend, you know, mechanical wise, it wasn't really his fault, but he's outperformed Bottas, you know, and we know how good and how much of a known quantity Bottas is. So extremely strong showing from Joe and yeah, really, really nice to see.
And the good part for them, especially Bottas, was that he started the race going long, so he didn't really have to try to overtake too many people. He started on the hards, pitted at the safety car. The race worked out perfectly for him. Joe, two stopped, pitted at the safety car as well. The thing with them is they were terrible in the first two practice sessions. Now, of course, yes, it's practice. They can be experimenting and doing stuff, but I thought, wow, this might be Alpha's worst race of the year. Then the rain came, and of course, qualifying helped them out. So yeah, Alpha and Haas were looking very good, but the argument I have, and this is something I throw out to everybody here on the panel, anybody listening to the podcast at the moment, is would they have performed so well, Alpha and Haas, if it didn't rain in qualifying? And that's where I'm a little bit concerned.
Kyle?
Possibly not. I don't think over, definitely Haas, I don't think in the dry had very good pace. And it just shows that, look, as much as I'm a Mick Schumacher fan, he hasn't been doing very well this year. And the fact that in the wet that both cars were on the third row shows that car works really, really well in the wet. So I think it played into their hands. The Alphas, they've been pretty solid all most of the year, to be fair. Bottas has put some great, great performances in. So I think it helped Haas a lot more than it helped Alpha.
But qualifying matters less. If we're talking about race pace, then I'd say that the Haas looked quite fast as long as they lasted. I mean, Magnussen was up there, but he made an interesting comment. And I think this is what I really wanted to highlight about Haas and how they did this weekend. Because in qualifying, he said, we had no operational errors at all. I got put out every time. Yeah. When I could make lap time, nothing went wrong. Like this is possibly the first time I've ever seen Haas, the team, on top of operations the way that they need to be to take advantage of all the other stuff that's working well for them right now.
And remember, we spoke about them a few podcasts ago. Their upgrade, or their only upgrade of the year so far, is not coming until, is it Austria or France coming up? It's not coming for a while, until July. So to me, I'm actually disappointed in how the start of their season has gone. They're notoriously a team who starts well. They put all their budget and resources into this car. They needed to be scoring way more points than they have so far, because that car, in my opinion, is only going to get slower and worse, because technically, obviously, lower budget means less development. So they have to score points early on. And again, another missed opportunity today. You've got two cars that should have taken a great haul of points, and it just keeps happening to them. And they really need to figure out a way to stay consistent and score points and not risk anything. Keep it risk-free.
Yeah. And that's why it's such a shame with what happened to Magnussen on the first lap, because actually, I've just noticed now, he pitted on lap 7 to change that front wing, stuck a set of hard tyres on, and went to the end.
Oh,
he did 63 laps on those hard tyres. So he had, so that just shows they had some pretty good tyre deck as well.
Didn't even pit during the safety car?
Nope.
He was last during the safety car as well. Something must have happened there. That sounds very fishy. Why,
unless the graphic is wrong, but this is showing 63 laps on hard tyres, which is incredible.
No. Yeah. They didn't come in, and so he was 12th when they restarted after the safety car. And clearly they were hoping he would be able to defend that position. But the reality is the hard tires were good for 50 laps. They were not good for 63 laps.
Okay. Well, look, I want to kind of end this race segment of the show by asking you guys what you think about the safety car lottery. So, when the virtual safety car comes out, they get a cheap pit stop. So instead of a 20-second pit stop, they get a 10-second pit stop. When there's a safety car, pretty much if you are mid-race and you have gaps of like 4 or 5 seconds, you can come in and maybe just lose one or two places, but come out on fresh tyres with the crocodile bunched up. I asked the very simple question, would it be so bad if we just closed the pit lane during these safety cars? Kyle?
I'm absolutely, completely against this. We had this rule when, and oddly back in the refueling era, to try to neutralize the luck aspect to it.
Yeah.
And we had cars conking out of fuel, closing the pit lane. They do this in oval racing, and it flips everything on its head. It's getting your pit stop in before the safety car or before the caution comes out. No, I think it's a part and parcel of Formula One. And it's how you play it and the luck and what position of, it's just a luck game. And also some people are prepared to take a risk, like Red Bull being bold at the start, because we know we're going to lose a couple of positions, but let's just sort of take it. So I think that would be very, very bad to then close the pit lane, bunch them all up, and then the whole field would just react to each other and essentially do the same thing.
Help me understand this. So Tsunoda, no, hang on. Who was first to go off? Perez. Oh, that hurts. So Perez had that gearbox issue and parks up. People pitted to get a cheaper pit stop. Had Perez gone off and they had said, okay, so pit lane is closed. You can only pit if you were damaged from the incident that caused the virtual safety car. And if you're in that situation, then yes, you fix the issue, but there's also a 5 second hold, or there's a minimum pit stop time for people pitting during this issue. Everyone else can't pit during that time. The race is properly neutralized. What is the issue with that?
Well, because then you'd be left in a, it could work, but you'd be left in a bizarre situation where you'd either have the whole field doing nothing, or you'd have the whole field all piling into the pit lane and have like a pit lane race, or you have a half the field doing that and then circling down. So
no, that's what I'm saying. Close the pit lane. Close it.
Well, if you close it during VSC, like, I don't mind that. I think safety car, though, you can't, like Kyle's saying, right? I think closing it during a full safety car period is a bit, because you like to have that sprint after a safety car. Everyone's close. The gaps are there. But yeah, VSC, like, to save 10 seconds, that can change someone's race. Like, I don't know. I feel like that's it's an interesting concept.
I don't see the downside, Kyle, of closing the pit lane during a virtual safety car.
maybe not from through a virtual safety car, but then also what happens if you are just about coming up to your pit stop and you're then
drive through penalty.
Or you're just coming up to your pit stop and you need to make it on the tires. You're then penalized because
But by the end of the virtual safety car, I know it doesn't really work out like this, but at the end of the virtual safety car, you should have exactly the same gap as before the virtual safety car. You've not been pushing, so you're not using your tires, so you just pit as planned.
Well, no, but then your tires will lose temperature massively because you've got loads of less tread on it and you won't be able to fire them back up. So I think you would then unfairly penalise people who are just about to hit the pits.
No, I think you just pit. No, like your solution there, Kyle, right, is like, yeah, your temperature's gone. You're pitting anyway. So just come in and pit. And look, if you have to pit during a closed window, as we talked about, just make it a drive-through penalty afterwards.
Or say there's a minimum pit stop time during a VSC.
But there's, what are you trying to fix exactly?
Well, just the lottery, luck. I think. Yeah, just the luck element. Like, Matt,
Matt,
what's your take on this?
Well, my take on it is you can win or lose places during a virtual safety car. The gaps are meant to stay roughly the same, but they don't. You can, through clever use of your delta per mini sector, gain or lose time on your rivals. And this does happen. And we've seen it play out advantageously in places like Monaco for Red Bull, for example. I have less of an issue, therefore, keeping the pit lane open during a virtual safety car because it's not as big of a gain as a safety car.
Yeah.
I think the problem with the safety car is because the gaps collapse.
Because the gaps close, yeah. Yeah.
Cars with a big enough gap get a free stop and fresh tires, which lends them a competitive advantage against cars that can't do that without losing position. So if I was going to close it for anything, it would be for the full safety car, although I'm willing to cede to Kyle his point. Then what you get is a mad scramble to get in before it's declared.
So if you close the pit lane for a full safety car, the leaders might have to then, they lose all the advantage of any lead they've built up. They can't pit for fresh tires, so they could end up with a gap closed that they earned. They earned that gap, but then they have like worn tires and they end up dropping back down the field. So I do accept that the full safety car is a different issue, but virtual safety car maybe, because the whole point of the virtual safety car is to neutralize the race. If you can pit during the virtual safety car, it does not neutralize the race.
Yeah, but so the reason for doing this would be try to mitigate luck, but then it just causes luck in other aspects. so it kind of does not cure a problem. You'll just have other people, like if you cancel it, if you close a pit lane under a full safety car, then if you're, say you've got Red Bull or Mercedes 1-2, then the second driver or the second in the queue is going to be completely and utterly nailed and ruined on it. They can't stack them or do anything like that. So why? Yeah, you're trying to solve a problem and causing other problems.
Yeah, look, I think full safety car is bad because this is what happens, right? Let's say you're leading by 400 hours and then what they say is they go, oh, so pit now. Oh, now you're only leading by 1 second. Oh, but I was going to pit. So now you pit and now all of a sudden you're 19th. Yeah, you can't do it during a safety car period. But I hope that made sense because it made sense to me. But virtual safety car, I completely agree. You can close the lane because then it's everybody's good. The same. Nobody loses gaps.
Okay.
And just pit the tires later on. There's no refueling good. To deal with. Why not?
We've agreed, Matt. Virtual safety cars, we're going to close the pit lane unless you were involved in that incident, in which case they will impose a... Kyle, stop shaking your head. In which case they will impose a minimum pit time for pitting under the virtual safety car.
I disagree.
Okay, go on then.
I'm going to say that I think we can reach two safe conclusions. One is luck will always be an element, no matter how much you try to neutralize it. Two, I think I figured out how to convince Spanners that I'm correct in always closing the pit lane for the safety car, but not for the virtual safety car. And if we think back to the final race of the previous season, someone was able to pit and get fresh tires.
Don't do it.
And someone could not or chose not to. Yeah. If no one got fresh tires, what kind of an ending would we have seen then? And I'm just going to say that I think I probably convinced at least one person on this panel to suddenly agree with me.
Well, and I did get abuse for this on Twitter earlier, but it is worth pointing out once again that all the lapped cars were allowed to overtake under this safety car. But whatever, let's move on to the podium. A fantastic Canadian Grand Prix. And although I do have an aversion to street tracks in general, I have long said that the Canadian Grand Prix is in my top five of all F1 Grand Prix tracks in history. It is dependent on either a bit of bad weather or a safety car. But as I said in the intro, Montreal does deliver those things in the bucket load. So yes, this has been a fantastic and entertaining Grand Prix weekend. And now it's time to give out the awards. So first of all, we have the Good Thing Award. Yeah, it's been 8 years and this is still called the Good Thing Award. Thing of the weekend, Matt. What would you give your thing of the weekend?
Geez, you know, I really want to give it to Ocon outscoring Alonso, despite having a much worse weekend.
But Alonso was so much faster, a million times faster.
A million times faster. Yeah. I just like the delicious irony of that, appeals to me. So in fairness, maybe I should just stick with that. But I do have a second one I want to get back to if no one else picks it. Fair?
Yeah.
Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, you want us to go to someone else. So, Jono?
Yeah.
All right. So, this is the good thing. I was going to go with the crowd invasion, but that's boring. I'm going to give it to Yuki Tsunoda for making me laugh. That was one of the dumbest accidents I've ever seen in Formula One history.
He said he hit a bump.
I think it's one of the dumbest accidents in history, certainly in the top five, behind the Stroll Latifi one this year in Melbourne, the Taki Inui one. When Luca Badoa hit the car in Parc Fermé in 2009, if anyone remembers that, in Belgium. And what was the other one, Carl? Was it Coulthard at Adelaide in 95?
Yep. Well, we have two. There was Coulthard on the entry to the pit lane in Adelaide in 95. And the only other one I can think of who crashed coming out of the pit lane was Gerhard Berger in 93 at the Estoril Grand Prix, coming out and the attraction shot and just binned it out of the pits. That was the only time I could think of a driver binning it straight out the pit lane.
That was Estoril or Hungary? Oh, it doesn't matter.
No, it was Estoril. He booted it out of the pit lane, screwed across the track and straight into the barriers.
So if we're talking historical crashes and we're talking Montreal, what about Hamilton fully just piling into Raikkonen?
The pit lane. Yeah. Oh, that's another one.
In the pit lane. Tsunoda's crash is no worse than that.
Okay. So on a scale of Taki Inui being hit by the medical car, no, his car, for people who haven't watched Formula One, his car didn't get hit by the medical car.
Yeah,
he got hit by the medical car.
Broke his leg.
Right? Yeah. So on a scale of he's the dumbest accident in history to, I would say, Stroll Latifi this year in Melbourne qualifying, I'd have to rank that like a Tsunoda, like a 7 out of 10 for worst in history today. That was so funny. So clumsy, and thanks for making me laugh, Yuki, at 5:30 in the morning.
Okay, to be fair, Matt, he was beating Gasly at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's been looking better against Gasly. Had a particularly ghastly weekend, so, you know. Mm-hmm.
Kyle, your thing of the weekend.
My thing of the weekend is actually, for once, I'm going to praise the race directors and race direction qualifying and not mollycoddling everyone and actually having the bravery to release the cars on a very wet track, letting them go and qualify. And because I get very angry in these wet sort of scenarios where I was like, if you just had the cars out on track, the water wouldn't settle. Like, get the cars out on track and it would be less bad. And the conditions were atrocious, and with the puddles, and I'm amazed they didn't red flag it, because if they had red flagged it, we would have sat there all night waiting for it to start, and they didn't. And also not being massively trigger happy with the red flags when Albon stuck it into the barriers. Remember at Imola, they would have just instantly pulled for a red flag. And I think they've listened to some of the feedback. They've let them sort it out. They've treated them a bit more like adults and not school children. And they've let them go, take a bit of risk and go for it. These are the best drivers in the world, and they actually treated them like it for once. So my thing of the weekend is, Thank you, Race Direction. Thank you for letting them actually go and be Formula One drivers.
All right. Very good. Matt, did they take any of your choices?
No. My other thing of the weekend was Joe getting into Q3 on the radio. That was so delightful. I loved every second of it.
Okay, well, I'm giving my thing of the weekend to Carlos Sainz because it was a shot in the arm. And yes, I know his teammates started from the back, but he gave everything that you would want from a Ferrari driver up front, giving it his all against Max Verstappen. Come on, John, are you going to argue with me for Carlos Sainz?
I got taught this year is never praise politicians when they release a media statement saying politician does his job.
Oh,
this was Carlos Sainz, right? Carlos Sainz does his job and finishes second, which is what he should have done. And you're going to praise him for that.
I think
he didn't do better than what he's supposed to be doing.
Oh my goodness. So I think I've fallen foul of just like wanting like goodwill. So basically, like, he's been a struggling hitter and he's got to first base finally instead of striking out, and I'm praising him. That's what I've fallen for. That's what I've done.
That's what I reckon.
Oh,
praise him for that. He's done his job.
Sorry,
well done,
Matt. Matt, I tried. I tried to praise Carlos Sainz. I tried.
I appreciate the amount of effort that completely genuinely showed.
It was genuine. But the second that Jono made that argument, I went, oh yeah, no, I'm wrong.
Sorry, mate.
Yeah, I failed. Okay, now we've been all positive. It's the bad thing award.
Oh no, you missed the apex.
Who missed the apex for you? Kyle Power. Who are you judging this weekend?
I never pre-think of these, and I feel very much on the spot.
So, the lesson is never go to Kyle first, is the lesson, okay.
But I'm going to have to give it to our very own magician. The magician.
Oh, no, that was
Alonso.
Mine.
Oh, sorry saying on the radio, even when your teammate is trying to help you, yes, but even though the straight line, I've been 100 times faster all weekend. So I think he was kind of inferring that he wanted the position swapped.
And the thing is, it wasn't like Ocon was like behind a train that Alonso could have then gone and attacked. There was a 5-second gap ahead that he was never going to catch at that point.
Yeah.
So all he was saying was, just swap us and just give me that place.
Yeah, and it's like, come on, man. It's like, well, that wasn't very nice.
Well, Trumpets mentioned, I don't know if it was pre-podcast, I don't think this was live, but you said that the reason Alonso sort of kept that position was because Ocon kind of dragged him along with the DRS. So had he gone ahead, maybe he would have been swept up.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I think they actually swapped them in. They pitted Alonso when they didn't really have to get him behind Ocon because they knew he had this problem. So they knew Ocon had to give him the DRS to keep Alonso, otherwise he would have plummeted down the field. So it was a very surprising and a bit of a
wide-eyed
demand. It was like, okay. Yeah, so that's my missed apex.
Just a factual correction. Ocon was ahead, I believe, of Alonso, and they both pitted under the safety car at the same time.
Okay.
Fanboy. Bias.
Yeah.
Matt, what is your missed apex award this week?
My missed apex award is Aston Martin, who just went utterly missing in qualifying.
Oh yeah,
and failed to fix that very much during the race.
Kyle,
they did fix one thing though. Lance Stroll went from 17th and got a point.
Well, safety car for sure.
Yeah, but still, he always seems to do this at his home event. This is the third time he started from the back and come through and got points. And he also won me £6. So cheers, Lance.
You bet on Lance Stroll to get points.
Who bets on Lance Stroll?
Because he's got form. He's done it twice before. And I've got a feeling he's going to do it again. Cheeky £1 bet. Nice one, Lance.
Oh, fair enough.
What a waste of money.
Only gamble what you can afford to lose. Stop when the fun stops. Who haven't we done here? So we did Kyle underprepared. We did Matt. So, Jono, who missed the apex for you?
Who missed the apex? Well, Sonoda definitely missed the apex today. I'll tell you that much. I was going to give it to the fan on Friday who brought out a VSC for throwing a beer can onto the track. But it was ruined by, I was looking through the driver standings. I completely forgot Nico Hülkenberg drove this season. And Nicholas Latifi is behind Nico Hülkenberg in the driver standings. I didn't even know Nico Hülkenberg was in Formula One for like 2 years. Like, I just completely forgot that Vettel had COVID. That is, my word, a terrible miss the Apex Award, Nicholas Latifi. Step up the game, mate.
Yeah. So, yeah, unfortunately, my missed Apex Award was also going to go to Nicholas Latifi, but it was for groundhog murder. Because he did kill a groundhog, I think, into turn three. And bless him, he sounded like really devastated that he'd done it. But obviously, once you hit the brakes, you can't do anything. But it's like in, Mount Panorama in Australia, where you have a kangaroo flag? Yeah, they should have a groundhog flag, possibly, in Montreal as well.
Was that during the race?
It was during qualifying, I think, wasn't it?
It was during qualifying. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
But I will give Latifi the Miss Apex Award because yet again, he is being shown to be very much ballast on the F1 grid. Like, he was so far behind everyone yet again. Even after the safety car, he kept dropping back. And it's not a one-off thing. Race after race after race, Albon is in the mix and he is way out of contention.
I've got a great idea. I just thought of it right now. Instead of sprint weekend, why don't we have, like, you know, the greyhound races where all the greyhounds chase one thing? Put Latifi one lap ahead at the start of the race, and then everyone has to try and catch him.
And then you just mean. Oh my god!
And then I don't know, like, that would be pretty exciting because it'd be like lap 65 of 70. You're like, oh, Latifi's leading by 1 second, and they all pass him and they win.
Okay, are we being too cruel to Latifi?
Yes.
Okay, fine. But George Russell was Mr. Saturday, and he was out driving the Williams. Now, Albon is Mr. Saturday and out driving the Williams. Could it not just be that any teammate of Latifi is going to look like Mr. Saturday? Sorry, Matt, I was turning to you. I thought you were going to defend Latifi.
I'm just going to say the word Mazepin and walk out of here.
All right.
I think you could pick the right teammate and Latifi would look good. But I think if you're talking current Formula One drivers, you'd have a hard time finding that particular driver.
Which is why we need to go back to 26 cars on the grid, because I think there's a saturation of talent.
Yes,
there are a lot of drivers right now who should be on the grid. Piastri should be on there, and I could name a whole lot more.
We're going to get out of here, but you do need to follow Jono. Jono, tell us where you are on social media.
I am at JonnySS8. I'm going to spell that, JonnySS8. Not just Twitter. Please go on Instagram too. I'm on both. So check me follow. I'll try and post some interesting stuff.
What are you posting on Instagram? You on boats?
No, I'm not that, unfortunately, not that rich. Okay. But I'm, just random stuff.
Okay.
Some interesting, funny things, food. I went to a dress-up party the other day. Me and my partner dressed up as Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. It's pretty funny.
Which one were you?
Well, I was obviously Johnny Depp.
Pirates of the Caribbean. Good. Go and follow Jono. We'll put a link in the show notes below. Follow Kyle at KylePowerF1. You're Twittering more, which I like.
I comment on things. I lurk.
In there.
Like, all social media, I lurk. I like to lob grenades in from the side every now and then. Mm. But yeah, I do tweet. I go through phases. Like all good things, I go through phases.
He's there. Go and follow him. Matt at MattPT55. You lob grenades in from the very far left, if you don't mind me saying.
Well, I mean, you know, which would be sort of the dead middle of your country. But yeah.
Oh, touche. Okay. Or you can also follow me. I'm at Spanners Ready. I'm the best one. Make sure you follow me. Or you can be my friend on Facebook by searching for Richard Ready. You're going to be sick of me by the end of the week. I'll be popping up all over the place. I think we are going to catch up with Kevin Clark from the Ringer F1 podcast on Tuesday as well. We're going to deliver a magazine show that you're going to love on Sunday with a variety of guests. Until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast. So I know I'm tired. I know Kyle's tired. Jono's okay. He's just starting his day. And Matt is only just getting into the sherry zone. But boy, oh boy, am I looking forward to crashing. We've gotten out of here before midnight. Wrong but first has never applied more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.